Good morning. I am going to call this meeting of the State Government Finance and Policy Committee for Tuesday, March 25th to order. We will need to dispense with the minutes. Vice Chair Davis, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, so moved.
We have a motion to approve the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. I have the first bill up, so I'm going to let the Vice Chair take over as I move to the testifiers table.
All right. Chair Nash has House File 1151, which I am being told is being laid over for possible inclusion. Would you like to move
your
bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move 1151 to come before the committee, and I have an A1, and I will move that to put the bill in the shape that I would like.
Very good.
We'll need to engross the amendment.
What do I do?
I have made a motion to engross the amendment. We would need to just take a vote.
All those in favor of the A1, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Very good. Passed.
It was touch and go,
Mr. Chair. Yes, it was.
Well, good morning, Chair. Today we have before us House File 1151, and it is a bill that has been brought to us by Minnesota judges. It deals with the Compensation Council statute, and that's within our committee's purview. And it's a very straightforward bill. It opens up a timeline for the Compensation Council to review, consider, and recommend pay raises consistent with the change that they have by our charge that they have by statute. And it changes the date from providing recommendations by April 1st in odd number years to September 1st in the even number years. I have with me now a testifier, Judge Kleinfelter, and I will ask him to explain the greater details of the bill, and then we can move on.
Please tell us who you are for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Jeremy Kleinfelter. I am a district court judge. I am chambered in Fillmore County in the 3rd Judicial District. I spend most of my time there, but I'm also frequently in Olmsted County, which is Rochester. I am a member of the Minnesota District Judges Association. I'm here on that organization's behalf today. I am currently the co-chair of the Pensions and Benefits Committee. MDJA is a trade organization of over 300 Minnesota judges. It includes nearly every district court judge, most court of appeals judges, and Supreme Court justices, as well as many retired and senior judges. In fact, it was a senior judge who graciously agreed to take the mass arraignment calendar in Rochester for me today. I have that calendar all week, and so it's a pleasure to be here today, even if for a few minutes. I am speaking in support of H.R. 1151, a bill jointly supported by MDJA and the judicial branch. It impacts the work of the Compensation Council regarding its timing, as indicated, and communication with MDJA judges. With respect to the timing piece, it is a request to change that report date from April 1st in odd-numbered years to September 1st in even. That will allow both MDJA and the Judicial Council to weigh Compensation Council recommendations before preparing budget numbers to the Governor's Office in mid-October. It is also more time for the legislature to digest that information as well. MDJA tries to present fair, data-driven evidence to the Compensation Council for consideration. In fact, this current cycle, Dr. King Banyan, an economist at St. Cloud State University, presented within the last few weeks a report on his research and recommendations. Second, that component, the Amendment A1, is simply to clarify that MDJA judges can present to Compensation Council during public testimony and engage council members formally and informally at council meetings. Perhaps it's just an abundance of caution, but frankly, when judges hear ex parte communication, it really grabs their attention. And so we simply want to make sure that that is permitted under the current statutory language. With that, I'm told that the committee appreciates brevity. That concludes my remarks. Thank you for sponsoring the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability.
Thank you, Judge Kleinfelter. To member discussion.
Mr. Chair, I'll just point out that my counterpart, Chair Cleaborn, and I have discussed this, and we are both in agreement with the bill as amended to be laid over and most likely included in our policy bill. So there's precious little controversy. And I mean, if you need me to start some, I can, but I choose not to. So,
seeing no discussion, with that, we will renew your motion to move our laying over House File 1151 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Next, we have House File 1239, a Representative Quam bill. And I will let Chair Quam move his bill.
Well, first I'd like the
we need to move your bill before the committee.
All righty. I move House File 1239 to be... I guess there's some debate whether it's to be to the general registry or to the public safety. And I'll move it before the committee.
Okay.
And we'll...
Let's go ahead and talk through the bill, and we can hear from our friends on the other side of the aisle as to how we're going to figure out where this goes. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Judy Randall, Legislative Auditor. Thank you for hearing this bill today. House File 1239 does something really, what we think is really simple, and it's also consistent with our effort to clarify reporting requirements for public agencies. When I was before the committee, I don't know, last week or the week before, I talked about how we have tried to look across the different statutes that require agencies to report possible or more likely evidence of misuse or fraud. And there's different laws that require different people to report different types of things. So we were trying to clarify some of the language in law. House File 1239 simply makes the requirements to report to the legislative auditor that are in 609.456 consistent with the requirements for local governments to report to the state auditor. So I have a copy of 609.456 in front of me, and in that law, it kind of has the folks who are required to report to the state auditor, public employees and public officers of a political subdivision, local folks, et cetera, when they have evidence of theft, embezzlement, unlawful use of public funds or property, et cetera, they shall promptly report to law enforcement and shall promptly report in writing to the state auditor a detailed description, et cetera. So that is simply the language that we were trying to adopt here so that it is parallel requirements to report to the state auditor as it is to the legislative auditor. We often, when we hear some of these concerns, we will tell the entity you need to report that to law enforcement. And so this puts that information in law so that they know and do it immediately rather than simply having to go through us first. And then the language we're striking there, except when to do so would knowingly impede or otherwise interfere. What we have found is that some state agency folks have used that as a reason to not report things to us. We, of course, are bound by the Government Data Practices Act. We cannot share information with anybody who's not allowed to see it. Often when we get this type of information, we share it with law enforcement directly. That's our standard practice. So I view this as a cleanup to, again, be parallel with the state auditor. Happy to have discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Member questions? Chair Cleaborn?
Thank you. And Representative Quam, the problem that we're having on our side of the aisle with this bill and why I suggest that we lay it over for possible inclusion is for us to figure out really where is, you know, law enforcement is so broad, right? Does that mean I report to my local Plymouth police? Who do we report to, right? So should it be the reporting to the BCA? How should we do this? If the auditor already receives complaints and the auditor whose eyes we trust then says, okay, this is legitimate, it needs to go, that power already exists. So that's why we have the confusion. That's why we have a disagreement as to whether or not this is something that we are clearly ready to vote on today and to move out of committee or if we should lay it over. So I would ask that you give us the time, please, to figure out the best way and how we would define law enforcement, or if we just say the practice that the auditor currently has is working sufficiently and we just leave things alone. So my recommendation would be that we continue, you and I, to work together and get clarification on this, and we hold it over for possible inclusion.
Auditor Randall, would you like to respond to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Cleavorn. I'm happy to have side conversations with you about the language. I'm happy to have it laid over for possible inclusion in the policy bill. Again, it's to clarify. I would say the same types of questions could exist at the local level, you know, and it's the exact same language for reporting to the state auditor. It always depends on the nature of the allegation, and so I think it's important to leave it open. It's never wrong for whomever it is to contact the local police officer, and then they can direct the right place. I have seen delays in reporting to law enforcement that have been problematic, and so that is something I would like to avoid so that they don't rely, you know, they take a while, they report to us, we look at it, and then we get back to them and say, you need to report this to law enforcement. I'd like to circumvent that a little. Happy to have further conversations. Thanks.
So I think in the interest of trying to find the best solution, it's probably wise to lay this over. I don't know that there's opposition to the idea of what the bill is trying to do. I think that the question is, what is the ultimate law enforcement pathway? So, but I'd like to hear from the author. So, Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, then the idea is we should be doing the same exact work on the state auditor, because the language is copying and mirroring the state auditor. Therefore, I understand that one half of the committee is very interested in clarifying this for the state auditor as well. And so when amendment or when any action is done or anything reaches the floor, I will make sure that everything that's clarified is also clarified for the state auditor, so we have consistency throughout our government.
And I will direct everybody towards 609.456, subdivision 1. Relative to the state auditor, it says that an officer shall promptly report to law enforcement or shall promptly report in writing to the state auditor. So Chair Quam's point is well made, that it is mirroring existing language that exists for the state auditor. We can either work this out in the policy bill or we can talk about it now, but if the goal is to provide mirrored services or mirrored policy from one auditor to the next, I would be curious as to the Chair Cleavorn's perspective on that. Madam Chair.
You and I discussed this previously yesterday, and I just believe that it's better before anything leaves to either go to another committee or to the General Register that you and I have agreement on the language and what the definitions are and how it's done. So I would prefer us to deal with this in the policy bill. Thank you.
Okay. In the interest of unity and alacrity for the bill, we can lay this over. Auditor Randall and Chair Quam can work with myself and Chair Cleavorn to make sure that we have this in a shape that we'll be able to pass in the policy omnibus bill. So, Chair Quam, closing thoughts?
I look forward to a energetic discussion on making government better.
With that, Chair Quam renews his motion that House File 1239 be laid over for possible inclusion. Laid over. We'll now move on to House File 1240, another Quam bill. Representative Quam, I believe you have, you'll need to move your bill since you are a member of the committee, and I believe you have an A1 as well.
That's correct. And is my understanding that this one will be able to be moved and re-referred to the General Registry?
Representative Quam, I believe that this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the policy bill as well. Okay. So Chair Quam moves 1240 and moves the A1 to the 1240 to put the bill in the shape that he would desire. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor? Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Quam, to your bill as amended.
I would like the auditor to explain why the amendment was brought forward and the present status of the bill after amended.
Auditor Randall, you have not left the testifier table, so you don't need to introduce yourself for the record. Please just proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You all may remember this bill from a week or two ago. The amendment deletes sections 4 and 5. After conversations with this committee and several other members, we decided it was prudent to simply remove those sections. And so what remains is simply, I'll just do a really quick walkthrough since I've already done this walkthrough, but I know you hear a lot of bills. Section 1 establishes a special reviews division in the Office of the Legislative Auditor. As you may know, we have a special reviews unit right now. The work of that unit has grown enormously over the last 5 years. Establishing it as a division better reflects the role it has at OLA and in state government. Section 2 clarifies two other areas where we can conduct, where the Office of the Legislative Auditor can conduct special reviews on line 212. What it does is it expands from simply non-compliance with finance-related use of legal requirements related to the use of public money, and it expands it to non-compliance with any legal requirements, as I mentioned last time. Examples of this would relate to licensing, for example. We often receive complaints or allegations about boards who maybe are not following laws related to licensing or conflicts of interest, things like that, and so this would allow us to conduct a special review when we receive allegations similar to those. Line 216 also gives the special reviews unit slash division the ability to follow up on prior special reviews. This is language that parallels OLA's authority to do follow-ups on program evaluations. And then Section 3 gets back to that whole reporting issue that I've been talking about, where agencies have different information in different sections of law about who has to report what. So Section 3 clarifies that. I'll note we've also worked a lot with agencies over the past year to understand their practices. We issued reporting guidelines to agencies. We've been meeting with them. We presented to the enterprise-wide internal controls group of 200 staff to talk through reporting requirements. What we have learned is that there is a real lack of understanding out there about who should be reporting what to OLA, so I'm hopeful that that law cleans it up, that language cleans it up. And then finally, current Section 6, but of course it would be renumbered to be, I believe, Section 4, is related to that reporting requirement. And it basically directs agencies to have a process in place, and it directs Minnesota Management and Budget to establish an enterprise-wide policy. I did speak with Deputy Commissioner Ray Tan at MMB yesterday about that, and we have a common understanding that that policy would be pretty high level, because of course it has to extend across the enterprise, but then also the specifics would be left to agencies on how to implement their reporting requirements. Current Section 7, it would become Section 5, repeals a section of law that was last touched in, I believe, 1984, that allows OLA to conduct IT audits. Super wish I could go back and be a fly on the wall in the discussion in 1984 about those IT audits, but we have updated language now that allows OLA to conduct those audits. Also, this old language references the State Information Systems Advisory Council, which I don't think is still in existence. And it says that local governments could direct OLA to conduct IT audits. We don't have authority over local governments, and I don't think the current legislature at least would be interested in having that entity or local governments direct the work of OLA. And that is the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Auditor Randall. We will now move on to member questions. Members. Representative Cleburne, did you have? Please proceed. Please proceed.
Thank you. And I appreciate the conversations that we had between the first presentation of this bill and today. So thank you. And I appreciate, Chair Quam, your removal of the two sections that were somewhat problematic. My question is that while I understand this is a policy bill, the things that we are doing are expanding the abilities of your office to go back and do special reviews and things like that. There is no appropriation in this bill. Are these costs that your office can currently absorb?
Auditor Randall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Cleburne, for the question. You're right, there are no costs associated with this bill. Yes, the short answer is yes, we can absorb these costs, in part because we do a lot of prioritization and reprioritization, and so this allows us to prioritize, you know, have these types of issues and allegations included in our prioritization.
Thank you very
Chair
much.
Chair Cleburne.
No, that's all. Thank you. And I, again, appreciate the work both of you have done in the interim of this bill.
Members, any other questions? Chair Quam. Just,
I want to reassure the committee, the OLA has a lot of data that they look at. Even being on the Legislative Audit Commission, we don't see a great deal of the detailed data because we're not supposed to. It's private, it's protected, and as to the special reviews, that's been a standard activity. It's been increasing because they're responding to legislators, to committee chairs, to people that are working in the agencies to look at things. And the sooner that we actually look at these things, the higher probability we can prevent mistakes or misuse and save the taxpayers money, but also save us to where we spend money to help people and it isn't getting to them or doesn't hit what we're supposed to do. The legislative auditor is a function of the legislature so we can do our job better and so we have some feedback in how we can improve the system. And that's part of why I'm so passionate about this because I've seen a lot of things over the years, but I've also seen where we have taken information from these audits and made our government better and more responsive to our citizens. And thank you for the time.
Thank you, Representative Quam. With that, Representative Quam renews his motion for House File 1240 as amended to be laid over. Next, we have Representative Howard. And if I could do a Geraldo Rivera voice, I would say that it's House File 2020, for those of you who know what 2020 is. And as you are a member of the committee, you can move your bill.
Thank you, Chair Nash. I would move my bill before the committee.
House File 2020 is before the committee. Please proceed.
Chair Nash, members of the committee, House File 2020 is a bill that comes to me from a constituent. Mr. Schoenbaum, who will testify, has had a long and distinguished career in state government and is now retired. He was diagnosed with ALS in recent years and has been working to make sure that he has the health care he needs to be safe and stable in his home and work with his spouse to make sure that she has the health care she needs as well. This bill addresses a quirk in our state statutes that may prevent Mr. Schoenbaum and his wife from accessing the health care in a way that works best for them. And we have worked with MMB in drafting this bill. It does not carry any objections or fiscal costs, and any cost within CGIPS would be negligible. I think I'll just stop there and turn it over to Mr. Schoenbaum to explain in more detail why this bill is important and necessary.
And we have Mr. Schoenbaum on Zoom, and we will have him ready to go. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Schoenbaum, and I've been retired for 7 years from a rewarding career in state government. On retirement, my wife and I signed on to the state retiree health plan. It's good insurance. We're happy to pay the full cost of it, and it contributes a lot to our peace of mind. As Representative Howard mentioned, a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with ALS, and the problem corrected by this bill came to my attention while I was planning for home care and insurance. As experienced by many people, it's possible our resources will be depleted by my care and I'll end up on Medicaid. We've been prudent, and I hope that doesn't happen, but we need to be planning in case it does. Retiree spouses, in other words, in this case, my wife, are eligible for health coverage and are eligible to continue coverage when the retiree dies. But under current law, if the retiree ends their coverage for any reason before death, the spouse loses coverage. In our case, if I exhaust my resources paying for care and go on Medicaid, my group insurance would end and my wife would lose her coverage. So if I die while insured, my wife can continue coverage, but my disability would kick her off if I've had to switch to Medicaid. So the bill adds an exception for spouses in situations like ours, allowing them to continue purchasing retiree insurance. The retiree plan is entirely funded by retiree premiums and is not subsidized by the state, as Representative Howard mentioned. So the bill would give peace of mind to me and other retirees who end up in this situation. Many thanks to Representative Howard for taking up this issue, and thanks to all of you for your time and consideration.
Mr. Schoenbaum, thank you for your testimony and for being here early this morning. Representative Howard, or I will go to member questions first. I see Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question as just to say thank you for bringing this forward. I think we've clearly exposed a loophole here that probably needs to be filled, and I think it's important to make sure that we're able to continue to coverage, and particularly the gentleman, our testifier. You know, I know ALS is a very difficult disease. I've watched it within my own family, that it can be very trying for families, but this might be one step in the right direction to help remedy some of the stress on those families. So I appreciate the bill.
Members, any other? We'll be laying it over. We are laying this bill over. Representative Howard, would you like to give your closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair Nash and members of the committee. I just want to thank Mr. Schoenbaum. I think this is an example of how the legislative process should work, constituents bringing us ideas, challenges, and us finding solutions. And so I'm grateful to work on this bill and hope that it helps Mr. Schoenbaum and other Minnesotans.
Thank you, Representative Howard. And with that, House File 2020 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, we will now have Chair Cleavorn. Yeah, let's, you want to do 2451 first and then go back?
Yeah, sure. I'll
do that. Let's do that. Okay, so we're going to move to House File 2451. Do you want to pitch from where you are? Okay. As you are a member of this committee, you can move your bill before.
So 2514, I move before the committee. This is a very simple bill, which is actually going to be a vehicle bill for a potential state government policy bill. It's written wrong on here. 2451. Mm-hmm. Sorry. That's the wrong one. We're doing the Joint Legislative Studies governing bill.
Actually, we were going to go to 2451, the Office of Administrative Hearings.
Oh, you're going
to
do
just
that
to clear, just so that the judge can be on her way and not have to sit through the other.
I thought you were doing it later. Sorry. Oh. So there's my confusion. Then I will go there.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. So as Chair Cleavorn is going to the table, Judge Starr, thank you for being here. I will. I'll move 2451. To come before the committee.
Apologies, I thought we were doing the
I just thought bill. That since the Sorry. Judge was here, we could move her on her way. Because no. While the committee is scintillating stuff, you don't always want to stick around for everything.
So exciting. So I will move House File 2451 to be before the committee. We do have a small amendment. We have it drafted as an A1, but I don't see it in the packet. So I would ask Mr. Sullivan if he could just walk us through. It would be on page 3, line 25, the insertion of the word or. So Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Sullivan is making his way to the table. Post. Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, yes. As Co-Chair Cleavorn indicated, there's a word missing in the bill currently as introduced. So the additional word would be on page 3, line 25, after the semicolon, insert or.
It is a drafting error so that Mr. Sullivan caught. So I'm just asking, if you don't have the A1 in the packet, then I would ask that it be an oral amendment just to clarify the bill.
And Representative Cleavorn, we just checked there was no amendment submitted, so we'll just have Mr. Sullivan state that once more for the benefit of the committee, and then we will vote on it as an oral amendment to put the bill in the shape that you would like. Mr.
Thank
Sullivan.
You.
Mr. Chair and members, Co-Chair Cleavorn moves to amend House File 2451 as follows. Page 3, line 25, after the semicolon, insert or.
Okay, not a controversial amendment unless we'd like to slug this one out. So we have an oral amendment to put the bill in the shape that Representative Cleavorn would like. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Chair Cleavorn, to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much. You will see in Section 1 that it changes the name of the Office of Administrative Hearings to the Court of Administrative Hearings. This reflects the courts as an independent place within the executive branch where people can come to resolve their disagreements. So it's just more a clarification for the general public. You will see in Sections 3, 4, and 5 codified an opportunity for remand when such actions protects due process. Remand means that they would send the case back to the court for further action, and this is to ensure fairness and justice in our systems. You will see that Section 6 are revisor directions reflecting the change from office to court. And then in Section 7, it repeals two campaign complaint-related claims of action that have been identified by the higher courts as not constitutional. And if you need further explanation, the Chief Judge Starr is here.
Judge Starr, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jenny Starr, and I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge for the state of Minnesota. I oversee the Office of Administrative Hearings. I know your time is short, and I think Chair Cleavorn gave a good summary of the bills. Would it be okay to move on to questions, Mr. Chair?
We can move on to member questions. Members, seeing nothing, Chair Cleavorn.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the great work that happens in the current Office of Administrative Hearings. I appreciate your support, both for the oral amendment and for the bill, and that is what we have. And I understand you plan to lay this over for possible inclusion. Is that correct?
Yep. With that, Chair Cleburne renews her motion to lay House File 2451 as amended over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
And since you're there, okay. Judge Starr, thank you for joining us this morning to do a little walkthrough.
That's okay.
We'll give you a moment to hook things up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, please proceed.
So as I mentioned, I'm Jenny Starr. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. I'm here with General Counsel Abigail Rankin, who's been meeting with a number of you over the past few weeks. So after we're done with this presentation, please, if you'd like to meet with either of us to know more about our court, let us know. The Office of Administrative Hearings, excellent, renders justice through fair, timely, and impartial hearings and high-quality dispute resolution services. We are the largest of three courts that sit inside the executive branch of government. The other two courts are the Tax Court and the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. Our bench is 32 judges, and just to give perspective, 32 judges is the same as the bench in Ramsey County District Court. So while we are a small agency inside the executive branch, we are a substantial trial level court. We hear about 10,000 new workers' compensation cases that are filed each year, and about 700 new Administrative Procedure Act matters are filed each year. And we are very proud to do this in a highly efficient manner. And one measure of efficiency is our judge-to-staff ratio is approximately 1-to-1. In your typical judicial branch, the ratio inside a judge's chambers is about 1-to-3, and the court itself at a trial level is usually around 1-to-7. So we're highly efficient in our work. We are also really proud that we're highly effective, and these pie charts try to demonstrate that. In workers' compensation, so our highest volume of cases, about 70% of the matters that are filed at our court are resolved within the court process and without a full evidentiary hearing. 30% go on to be heard on their merits and decided by a workers' compensation judge. And of that 30%, less than 1% are appealed to a higher level court. And of that less than 1%, 3% are changed at a higher level court hearing. And so our work is viewed as accurate and complete, and some often, regardless of whether the parties received the result they were seeking, through our process, they're able to accept the result. Now, all of our judges at OAH are learned in the law. They are free of political and economic conflicts of interest. They report to the Campaign Finance Board, and they're subject to the Code of Judicial Conduct. And so they have strong decisional independence, which is part of the magic that makes a good court process run. Now, I want to show you this picture because there are some things that we do that are outside of your typical trial level court. Our administrative law judges preside over large public hearings in both rulemaking and boundary adjustments. And here is a picture of the over 1,000 people who attended a hearing on a proposed incorporation in the Baldwin Township. And if you look at the center of that picture, way back where the lights are, is Judge Jessica Palmer Denig. After this hearing and after this proceeding had completed, the township wrote to say that they would like to thank Judge Jessica Palmer Denig for a well-reasoned and well-resourced decision, and for so skillfully presiding over an emotional and energetic public hearing at which township residents were in attendance to voice their concerns for the future of their community. And this, I think, is really the value added that our court provides to the state of Minnesota and to all the people here within our state. Now, we are not alone. Over half of the states nationally have what's referred to as a central panel court. And what this means is that referring agencies, instead of hearing cases within their agency themselves, they refer their controversies to the central panel to be heard by an independent judge. We were the third state in the country to adopt a central panel, so we can be very proud of that. And states continue to model themselves like Minnesota, California, Wisconsin, early adopters, Idaho and Indiana being the most recent states to adopt a central panel court. Now, each court is unique. The jurisdictions that are decided by the legislature come from different pressures and time. So jurisdiction can be broad or narrow. Use of the court can be mandatory or voluntary. But all have a shared purpose, and that's a high-quality, effective, and efficient independent administrative judiciary. And this is also true. No jurisdiction that has adopted a central panel court has ever returned to a previous practice. And that's because we deliver on the value proposition of increasing public accountability in government, public engagement in government, and a trustworthy and just process. Our funding comes from three sources, the largest being the Workers' Compensation Fund. 70% of our caseload is in workers' compensation, and that correlates with the funding from the Workers' Compensation Fund. And then the next chunk comes from an enterprise fund. So referring agencies who refer a case to the Office of Administrative Hearings pay an hourly billable rate for our judges' time. Now, this is a good thing. It incentivizes agencies to resolve conflicts within their agency as much as possible to avoid the bill for hearing that controversy at OAH. And only 7% of our funding comes from the general fund, and that pays for cases that do not have a referring agency. So those are like fair campaign complaints. I've lost my role. Boundary adjustments and data practices. So those items that are filed by the petitioning party in our court have general fund funding. The governor's budget recommendation in that general fund account recommends an increase of $10,000 in the first fiscal year and $20,000 in the second fiscal year, and this is to accommodate just general increases in operating costs. Thank you. And again, here for questions, of course, and happy to follow up with anybody who would like for us to come meet in offices to talk further.
Thank you, Judge Starr. And I will say you have made yourself available to stop by the office and chat on a number of occasions. Even drove out to Waconia to have a cup of coffee after the election to sort of lay the groundwork for what we would be talking about. So, member questions? Hearing none. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind. Could you just talk a little bit about, on slide one, you talked about your office doing boundary adjustments and disputes. We've done a little bit of work in redoing our survey markers, and kind of a big endeavor that the committee has launched on. So could you just talk a little bit, I'm not as familiar with the work that you do, or maybe I am, but would prefer to hear a little bit about it.
Judge Starr.
Chair Nash, Representative, our boundary adjustment work is about the relationships between townships, cities. We do annexation work. I don't know if I am familiar with the relationship between that work and what you're describing. So I might need a little time to see if there is an overlap there that should be attended to.
Representative Kosnick.
Thank you. So the work that your office does with the boundary adjustments, it's more intergovernmental than
individual property disputes.
Judge Starr.
Chair Nash, Representative, the bulk of our work is intergovernmental. There are times when individuals can bring claims of action around the boundaries regarding property that they own. So that is possible. And so to your point, there may be an overlap that I should make myself familiar with.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further?
Nope. I appreciate it. It gives a little clarity, and I think it does probably build off of the other work that we've done in securing our markers and more properly identifying them. So thank you.
Very good. Well, I will again thank you for being here with us this morning and encourage members, if you have deeper questions, the judge is very available to you to meet with you or have a phone call. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Hey, we have been told that we're waiting on the Secretary of State, so Representative Cleavorn, let's move to your vehicle bills that you can pitch from right there. That having to go to the testifier table. So let's take 2514 up first.
Okay. Thank you very much. I move that 2514 be re-referred to the General Register. The piece that this bill does, and you'll see on line 1.10, it adds the word legislate assigned to an existing legislative, and the insertion is the word office or. That's the new insertion. Commission shall be made to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So it is just clarifying that information regarding an office or commission. And that's it. It's a technical vehicle bill, and we would ask that it go to the General Register, please.
Members, questions to 2514? Seeing none, 2514 is laid over for, or no, is being referred to the General Register. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Okay. On its way to the General Register. We will now move to 2515, Chair Cleavorn.
Okay. So we are having a discussion privately as to whether or not we should lay 2515 over in this committee. As a possible vehicle bill.
And I believe we have two or three vehicles in the possession of the committee, I think somewhere in that vicinity. But if you'd like to lay over another one, it's always good to have options.
I think the other two have your name on them, is that correct?
They do.
Okay, then we'll just lay this one over.
You can always add on those as well, and you know what they are since we've spoken about them.
Let's just lay this one over as well.
Okay, Chair Cleavorn moves 2515 to be laid over for possible inclusion to your bill.
And this one is modifying the definition of joint offices. And again, it is the insertion of on line 1.10. Joint offices means the reviser of statutes, legislative reference library, and it is the inclusion of the Legislative Coordinating Commission on line 1.10 and 1.11. And that is all that the bill does. And then we'll just lay it over for possible inclusion.
Members, question of the bill? Seeing none, we will lay 2515 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Yep. And members, we are still waiting on the Secretary of State to arrive, so I'm going to put us in recess until he arrives. We are in recess.
Thank you.
He was 5 minutes old. So, if there's a desire to make it so that they don't have to do it all the way for potentially like years, like who knows what it does, but it doesn't sound like that's what the feasible was.
No.
Yeah, so then I think it's fine. Like, I think it makes it clear, and then also.
Yeah.
I wanted to make sure that there was like a clear understanding that like school district cards are standalone and this was a combined location. Like that clerk isn't obligated to post something because like their school district, that local official's locations haven't changed, so that local like and make sure that that was the intent, that it wasn't like a issue or a co-location between like 2023, like going on to a school.
I thought the original change just next statewide general election would be okay, but yeah, it kind of seemed like there were some very decent rumors that they go for presidential.
Yeah.
And I guess once the posting is available, the
better late than never. Yeah. Boy, that got done quickly.
Okay, I'm going to call us back from recess. We are back in committee. We have Secretary Simon with us this morning for a presentation. Mr. Secretary, welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Members, thanks for your time and attention. I appreciate it. I know you have a lot of business today and otherwise. We are just here to give you sort of a budget overview. With me, of course, is Nicole Freeman, who you know, our Director of Government Relations. Just to level set, members, and I know you're going to hear from all the constitutional officers, but we are a constitutional office. I think it's worth saying for the record. We're not a department. We're not an agency. We don't report to the governor. He's not our boss. We answer directly to the American, not the American people, but the people of Minnesota.
Well, they are Americans.
I guess they are Americans. And subject, of course, always to your oversight. I'm a big believer in legislative oversight. It's what makes this state run. It's a good thing. So subject always to that. And of course, you have the power of the purse as well. So the Office of Minnesota Secretary of State currently has about 117 staff members in the four divisions of the office. Here are the four: business services, elections, administration, and safe at home. And as you can see, and this surprises some people, the biggest part of our office is not the one you think it is. Mr. Chair, I know you know this, but for the newer members, it is not elections. That's what we're best known for. That's what attracts the most interest, the most attention, yes, the most scrutiny, but that is not the biggest part of our office. The biggest part, as you can see by far, is business services. So let's go there. That division reviews, approves, and files articles of incorporation and amendments for all businesses and nonprofit organizations in Minnesota that conduct business in the state. So this division also maintains records filed under the UCC regarding collateral pledged to secure loans, as well as administering the Central Notification System, or CNS, for farm product liens, and files and maintains statewide federal tax liens. The UCC division within Business Services files an average of 157,000 UCC filings per year, processes on average almost 32,000 UCC orders per year. This division also contains a notary and apostille unit, registering notaries and certifying documents for international use. In 2024, the last calendar year, our office authenticated about 29,500 documents. That's up from 20,500 in 2018, so a huge increase just in the last few years. So there have been some new laws that we've had to administer and oversee. Things passed since 2022, including an initiative that we pushed in 2022. Many of you who were here supported it. It had broad bipartisan support, which was a bogus filer law, which allowed our office for the first time to reject clearly fraudulent filings, things like bogus liens filed against public officials, including some in the Minnesota House of Representatives, often from all sorts of political groups, left, right, and center. In 2023, the legislature created a new registration filing type called the Structured Settlement Purchaser, now to operate as that entity. An entity has to file with our office, submit a fee, and submit a sworn certification of a surety bond. Finally, Congress passed a really big deal in 2018 called the Corporate Transparency Act. It requires that as of 2024, certain entities doing business in the United States must report information about their beneficial owners, which is a fancy title for the people who ultimately own or control the company. Now, they don't file it with our office. They file it with the Department of Treasury. But this federal law did require that all secretaries of state across the country provide information about this federal requirement. So we are required under federal law to tell everyone filing a business that, yeah, you got to do this other thing with the feds. That is the subject of a lot of attention, some controversy at the federal level, and presently some litigation as well. So in terms of the totals, the work of business services continues to increase. Just as an example, the total filings handled in the division in 2024, the year just ended, were about 970,000. Go back just a few years earlier to 2018, that was 770,000. And that's an over 25% increase. You'll see here the new entities, the brand new ones, were just north of 68,000. So these increases in business services are the primary driver of our continued growth in the state general fund contribution. So, Mr. Chair, as you know, this is not your first rodeo. I always like to emphasize multiple times, this will be the first of a few, that we are a profit center for the state of Minnesota. You don't see that often in this committee or any committee. We make a lot more money than we cost. So if you add up every single thing that we cost, every person, every Post-it note, every paperclip, everything, every penny, we submit back to the state in excess of that $29 million per biennium. Or as you are fond of saying, Mr. Chair, we throw it over the fence every 2 years. So we throw $29 million over the fence. We don't keep one penny of that. It goes to you. It goes to the general fund. $29 million in excess of everything that we cost. So that's the net contribution. And that number continues to grow, not because fees have increased. Mr. Chair, as you and others know, most of the fees that we charge, you set them, not us, most of those fees have not been raised in over 30 years. So we're still a $29 million net contributor, even though, for example, a business corporation costs $135 to file a business corporation in this state. That fee, that $135 fee, was last changed by you, maybe not you as individuals, but by this body, in 1992. So we're going on 33 years since $135 has changed, and yet we still are raking in quite a bit for the general fund, even with those fees that haven't changed. That's why we're a net profit center for the state. So let's talk a little bit about the elections division. That is the next largest division, obviously, within the office and what we're most known for, obviously. While the work of the elections division is within the jurisdiction of the elections committee and not this committee technically, I just want to give a brief overview for obvious reasons. So the election work is primarily focused on elections administration, but the office also supports a county election security navigator team as well as a voter outreach team. So in terms of what the division does, trains and certifies county elections administrators, provides ongoing support and resources to local election officials, administers and supports the statewide voter registration system, or SVRS, which is the giant database that houses all the voter records. This division administers the database of candidates and the system for gathering and reporting unofficial election results on election night, tests and certifies all election equipment systems used in the state of Minnesota, conducts post-election performance audits and reviews, as well as administers the state canvassing board that certifies all state election results, whether it's a primary, a general, a special. The office also has rulemaking authority with respect to elections and regularly engages in rule development. And finally, this part of the office develops and supports online voter tools, including online voter registration, online absentee ballot applications, polling place finders, all the things that you and many of your constituents use. So I want to say a little bit about grants, because this is an important issue financially. So since 2017, the amount of grant money processed by our office has increased significantly, as you and the legislature have determined that that's the more efficient way often to do things. So we're kind of a funnel in that way. You and others in the federal government have appropriated money to us, and we're the pass-through. That's it. We don't keep it. We just effectively and efficiently administer it according to formulas that are either in law or otherwise understood with the stakeholders. So since 2017, the office has processed tens of millions in grants and reimbursements to local governments. One prominent example that some of you are familiar with who have been here for a while is when the legislature in 2016 passed the law establishing a presidential primary as opposed to caucusing to determine the party's nominees. Counties were at the table and cities were at the table, and they said, hey, if you're going to make us do three, not the usual two, but three statewide elections in a particular year, you've got to reimburse us. So the legislature, starting in 2016, did just that. And so you give us the money, and we keep track of the expenses of the counties, and then it flows through us, and we're the ones who do the reimbursing. So that's a prominent example. The Election Administration Division in the past 2 years has also been tasked with implementing some of the larger election law changes of the last several years. So I think you can see, let's just go to the next slide. Here are some of the things that were passed in the last few years. That requires a lot of people and time and attention and energy to administer some of those laws. The Elections Division also supports a team of three election security navigators. I know that Bill Ekblad has been before this and other committees frequently in the legislature testifying. He heads up our Security Navigator program. He's a career naval officer before coming to work for our office and is from Minnesota. These individuals are funded not with general fund dollars but by the Help America Vote Act, or HAVA, and are focused on assisting counties in their efforts to increase security and overall preparedness in election administration. So this team focuses its efforts on information sharing and collaboration, annual trainings, tabletop exercises, and importantly, getting out to all counties for in-person meetings and assessments. Last year, Bill Ekblad and his team literally traveled to all 87 counties in Minnesota, meeting not just with elections administrators in the counties, but all of their IT folks as well, to make sure that cybersecurity was intact, physical security was intact, and the like. So the next division in the office is the administration division. So administration includes communications, legal, government relations, but also other core administrative functions required by the Constitution and by state statute. So these functions include things like maintaining the statutory open appointment process for boards and commissions. Some of you know that we have hundreds of boards and commissions in the state. Our office doesn't do any of the appointing. That all happens, or 99% of it happens, in the executive branch. But we are tasked under law with running the selection process. We don't make the picks, but when someone applies for a state board or commission, they do it through a portal that we run. And this division also maintains official documents and session laws, and, of course, aids in the work of the State Executive Council and the State Board of Investment, on which the Secretary of State always serves. Finally, the last division in the office is the Safe at Home program. Many of you who have been here for a while are familiar with that program. It's always enjoyed broad and deep bipartisan support. This is the address confidentiality program that services Minnesotans who have significant safety needs. Sometimes these are people who are the victims of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, or people who have professional safety concerns, people like judges, prosecutors, people who want to keep their home addresses private and secret and confidential. So the program partners with social services agencies statewide to enroll people in the program. And once enrolled in the program, the participant is provided a substitute address that they can use as their legal address for all purposes, including voting. Enrollment has continued to grow, as you can see in this next slide, with just under 5,000 active participants at the end of 2024. And when I look at this number and when I look at this trend, and it's been an evident trend for the last few years, it's sort of, to me anyway, bittersweet. On the one hand, how great that we have a program in this state, and about 38 states have a similar program, that allows people this sort of haven, this sort of protection, which is really pretty unique and pretty special. So that's great. On the other hand, how sad that this many people rise to the level of needing this kind of security, because I think we can all agree things have to get pretty bad and pretty scary before you enroll in a program like this, where your home address is completely private, completely shielded for all purposes, public and private. Imagine for yourselves or your families how bad something has to get for you to be in a program like that. I'd say pretty bad.
And Mr. Secretary, I'll just harken back to, I think it was 2018 when our colleague, Representative Loon, brought the bill to implement this. I've been on this committee since I arrived here, and I honestly didn't think it would have as many people signing up for it as you've just shared. But I'm grateful that it did see a broad bipartisan support, because people on all ends of the political spectrum have people who wish to do them harm, whether it's a former romantic interest or somebody else. And this is just a very good layer of protection that we have for people who would like to not be out in the public, whether it's through a business filing or other things. So I do think that this is a very good use of your office's time and effort. Appreciate that we continue to make it well known, because I've seen it out in the wild being mentioned, and I know that folks do take advantage of it. And actually, I wish that we could do a little bit more sharing about what it does and how someone might sign up for it, because I've gotten a few calls. I'm sure other members have as well, and we've directed them to you. But it's a good program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your ongoing support over the years. And by the way, I just might add, a lot of times people who aren't as familiar with this program ask a very good question. They'll say, I get this on the street, people will say, save at home, sounds great, but can I ask you something? No offense. Why is this run out of the Secretary of State's office? Sounds like something a sheriff would do, or the Department of Public Safety, or maybe the Attorney General's office. No offense, but why are you doing this? And the answer has to do with the very first such program. There are about 40 right now, 38 or 40. The first one was in Washington State in the early 90s, and the reason it started in the Secretary of State's office there was they were finding that, unfortunately, clever and enterprising abusers were using the public voting rolls. Mm-hmm. That's how they found people, the voting rolls. And it sort of snowballed from there. Out of the 38 or 40 programs, the majority are run through offices of Secretary of State, handful maybe Attorney General, couple miscellaneous or sort of standalone entities, but that's why nationally these programs are mostly through Secretary of State offices.
And thank you for pointing that out, Mr. Secretary. Because business filings are something that can be searched, as are the voting record outputs, that's a very good use of the office to make sure that if somebody who is trying to escape an abusive relationship decides to go out on their own and starts a business, that filing, if they choose to, would not be publicly available to them. So
that's right.
Please proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you can see here more information about the growth of the program here. It's continued to grow. Like I said, we have just under 5,000 active participants at the end. So, and here you can see some data on the number of individuals served per year. This chart shows the increase between just 2022 and 2024, just those 2 years, in applications, participants, and households, as well as increases in costs and work that accompanies that increase in participation. Of note, you can see that the bottom two numbers relate to the mail that the office handles for participants. So one of the things we do is we handle the mail for folks. We get them their mail through other channels, not what would be their postal address that is attached to their house, which means we're at the whim of postal increases, right? We don't control that. That's not a matter of our office's efficiency or good work or anything like that. So postal costs have risen 41% just between 2022 and 2024. Again, not our doing. So that's just something that we don't want to have to pass along to others. Although this is the smallest area of the office by staffing level, it is incredibly important. This program, as you've said, Mr. Chair, helps keep people safe. I'm not going to read all these quotations. You can read them for yourselves. I have a couple letters that I like to read. I won't hear today as well, that are really touching and heartbreaking, handwritten letters of gratitude for what the program does. So on to the budget request. As I've mentioned in the presentation, all areas of the office's work have seen continued growth from Minnesotans seeking the services that we provide. And that growth, in addition to the cost pressures, like insurance benefits, like salary increases, like postage, that's why we're asking for an operating increase. This is what we need in order to keep our current levels of service. So this is running in place. This isn't sprinting out ahead. This isn't doing some new and fabulous thing. This is running in place. This is what we would need, literally things like postage and the like, just to do what we're already doing. So I'd note again that this growth is also reflected in the net contribution to the general fund from the Office of Secretary of State. When I gave this same presentation 4 years ago, in 2021, our office was contributing about a net $22 million to the general fund. Now our office, as I said, is contributing a net $29 million. That, again, $29 million above and in excess of every last scrap of everything that we cost. Every person, every paperclip, $29 million every biennium. As you say, Mr. Chair, over the fence to the general fund, we don't keep $1, one penny in any of that. So that increased revenue is a direct result of the increased work. The operating increase that we're asking for is less than the growth in our general fund contribution and ensures that we can continue to meet the needs of Minnesotans. The only other item in our current budget ask, other than the operating increase, other than running in place, is, as Chair Quam knows, one-time $200,000 in HAVA matching funds. So as some of you know, whether you've been on an elections committee or not, periodically Congress will appropriate money to secretaries of state under the Help America Vote Act or HAVA, but they always ask for skin in the game, which I think is actually not a bad policy. They say, states, you can have this money, but you got to come up with a 20% match in order to unlock it. So we got about $1 million in the last batch, let's say, from Congress, which means we have to come up one time, no tails, members. This is just one-time money, $200,000 to unlock the million. That's not in this committee's jurisdiction, but just wanted you to know about it. So our only request is operating increase running in place and the one-time $200,000 to unlock the million from the feds. I know the committee's pressed for time. Thank you for your accommodations. Happy to answer any questions now or later. You know where to find me. You can reach me anytime, after hours, weekends. Happy to answer your questions, take your comments, push back, criticism, anything you got. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We'll move on to member questions. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary, for being here. I am very interested. So I'm a first-termer, and so I've got a couple of first-termer questions. When you were mentioning the Corporate Transparency Act and the beneficial ownership information requirements, so does that mean that people can start to understand, like, who is behind various LLCs?
Mr. Secretary.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jones. Yes, that's exactly right. So Congress debated this for about almost 20 years. It was a post-9/11 piece of legislation. And the thought was that in the United States, unlike much of the rest of the world, Japan, Europe, other areas, when you file a corporation in our states, believe it or not, you don't have to say who owns it. You just have to have a – you just have to file it with a contact person who can accept service in case of a lawsuit. You have to provide an address. You have to provide a name of the company. You have to pay a fee, but you don't have to say who owns it, which has led in the minds of the proponents of the legislation, which was bipartisan. It was signed under the first Trump administration in 2018, has led to soft spots and openings for money laundering, terrorism, narcotics operations, because they can just file stuff in any state in the United States, and they don't have to say who owns the company. Don't have to say it. And so the Corporate Transparency Act said, yeah, from now on, under most circumstances, there are a ton of exemptions, exclusions, exceptions written to the law. But for the most part, the default setting is, yeah, unless you can find safe harbor in one of these other exceptions or exclusions, you got to say who owns you, like who's getting the money or who's ultimately liable. So that's the bottom line. Although, asterisk, it's sort of embroiled right now in litigation. A sense right now that the Department of Treasury, who administers this, might just limit it to foreign nationals and not American citizen. I think that's the stated policy of the current administration to sort of keep it on that level. But long-winded answer to your question, yes, this enables – and it's, by the way, it's not available to the public. This is not public information. So none of us could know who owns the X, Y, and Z corporation, but law enforcement and other tax authorities and others could get this information, not the public.
Representative Jones, follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Secretary. I have a separate question. Appreciate your answer on that one. You mentioned the increase in the total filings from 770,000 in 2018 or so to 970. I'm curious, do businesses ever fall off? I mean, I'm just wondering, like, are we just adding more and just people are forgetting about businesses and then we're just like, yeah, what's happening there?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Jones. It's a little bit of both, I'd say. What the economists are telling us and other states have seen similar trends. Part of the reason that we've seen a spike in filings over the last few years has to do probably with COVID. Just as after the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, there was also a spike like this in the number of filings. And the best guess of those who study this, which does not include me, by the way, I'm parroting what they say, is when you have disruptions like the Great Recession and like COVID, a lot of people strike out on their own. They might leave that job at the huge, huge and large company and file their own company or hang their own shingle. Or it's not necessarily a sign of distress. It can be, but it's also a sign of people sort of striking out on their own, starting their own businesses. So that's one. In terms of are these all just new or do some fall off? Yes, every year some percentage are what we call administratively dissolved. These are businesses that likely fell into disuse. Likely it was one person. Maybe they haven't filed for years and years and years. Maybe they're deceased. There's no way we could necessarily track that. And so they're administratively dissolved under certain sections. And then there are folks who just voluntarily say, my business is no more. I'm taking it off the rolls. I'm going on to something else, or I'm starting a new business, or I'm joining a company. So I think it's a combination of both.
Representative Jones, anything further?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's really enlightening. And so just to tie that together, so is there a lag on when there may be some administrative dissolution?
Mr. Secretary.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Jones. Yes, I forget now. I think it's changed recently, and I hate to put Ms. Freeman on the spot in terms of what the rule is for administrative dissolution, but it's some period of time that passes without a refiling. In Minnesota, when you file a business entity, you have to plunk down the one-time fee, but then annually you have to renew. You don't have to pay again. And by the way, fun fact, as I mentioned in our meeting, Mr. Chair, I'm the first to tell you Minnesota isn't on most people's lips when you talk about, you know, low taxes and fees, but this is one of them where we are. We're one of only 10 states, only 10, where you don't have to pay the fee every year. You only have to pay the fee one time. So if you're filing a business corporation, you pay a one-time fee of $135. And for the next 20 years, you do have to renew, but you don't have to pay $135 every year. We're one of only 10 states that does that.
And thank you, Mr. Secretary. I think the term is administrative termination. I believe that's correct. I'm not sure. But that comes when a company either goes dormant, doesn't refile, or someone forgets about something, or a partnership dissolves and they just let it go dormant. I know that that's not really common, but it happens. How often does that happen?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to check back with you. I don't want to mislead you by speculating. But let me, since I have the microphone on that question, let you know that one other thing, just for you and your constituents to know, we often will get understandably panicked calls or emails saying, you know, oh, man, I forgot to file this year. What's going to happen? Does that mean am I in, like, legal trouble? Does that mean, you know, the entity didn't have the authority to sign the contracts it signed because I forgot? No. The answer is you just pay a sort of late fee, and it's retroactive to the time of your last filing. So, no, there's no lapse in legal authority to do anything just because you forgot. I'll never forget getting a panicked text from a very prominent former legislator, who I won't name, who was worried that his business had fallen into that category. Does this mean the 100 contracts I signed in the last year are null and void? No, doesn't mean that. You just pay a small fee, it's a few bucks, and then retroactively you're reinstated.
And that was my next question, so you anticipated that. We will move to Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to see you, Mr. Secretary. My question also has to deal with the Corporate Transparency Act, which has caused a lot of questions for a farmer who may have his business organized as a family corporation. As I followed it, it was put into effect, then it was suspended, then a judge someplace put the program back into effect, and as you say now, it's subject to further litigation. So is there a timeline to this? Would you recommend farmers continue to file this and go through the expense of doing this, or should they wait to see if it's how it turns out in the court system?
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. Excellent question. We get that question a lot. Because of the ping pong of the litigation right now, the literal present status right now is that you don't have to file, neither your farm nor any other farm nor any other entity for that matter. It's really in legal limbo right now. The Trump administration, as I understand it, the Treasury Department, is trying to fall back to a position where the CTA will only apply to foreign nationals, which in its mind will substantially get at the underlying reason for this in the first place, which was terrorism, narco trafficking, and the like. So that's my understanding. But the latest and greatest right now, literally the legal landscape, is there is no legal obligation, but it's all subject to appeal. So my advice right now is that at this moment in time, as I sit here, there is no legal obligation to file. That could change with an appeals court. It's not a particularly onerous filing, but it's another thing, right? Another speed bump in your day, another thing that you got to do. So my assessment at this point is that the legal landscape is no, but it could spring back to life. We just don't know.
Okay. Any other questions for the Secretary? Chair Cleburne.
Thank you. And I just want to thank you for the great work that you do for the citizens of our state. And so since you have the ear of several legislators here that often review task force and commissions and things like that. Is there anything that you would want us to know about that small division that you have and the growing work that we are putting on to that?
Yeah. Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cleavorn. Yeah, I think there's been an explosion in the number of boards and commissions, particularly over the last several years. My understanding is it's been pretty bipartisan, and that's not a bad thing. I mean, hey, I think boards and commissions are a great way for everyday citizens who aren't political types, who are just all of your constituents, to get involved in an issue they're interested in. They meet other people from around the state. They dive into an issue area. Maybe they produce a report or some recommendations. So I think that's good. That there's no complaining. But it is what it is. It means more work for our office. We, a few years ago, as you may be aware, Representative, we redesigned the website. It's pretty cool, in my unbiased opinion, which is you can go there now and you can see any member of the public can now click on the application materials. So if you want to know even who applied for the board of XYZ and what they submitted in their application, it's just a few clicks away. But that requires people and IT folks and, you know, FTE time for people to administer the hundreds and hundreds of boards and commissions. And we handle, again, the intake process. We don't do any of the picking or appointing, but we handle all the intake process, all the applicants, forward that to the relevant agency or to the governor's office so that they make the ultimate picks.
Representative Cleavorn?
No, thank you. I just know that it's a very time-consuming process, and so I just wanted to bring that to the attention of the legislators. Again, thank you to you and your team for the great work that you do.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for being here. Any closing remarks?
No, just thanks for your time and attention, members. I know you have tough decisions to make. Thank you for giving me some time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And members, we have now fulfilled our agenda, and we are adjourned.